This is Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. Today on the show, McDonald Stainsby of oilsandstruth.org. Music from The Filthy Politicians and Count Zero. This is Rage, building a community of resistance one podcast at a time. Hello and welcome to Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. Coming to you from occupied Amiskwatsi, Wisconsin. I am your host, Seymour Life. And a special hello out there to all those who are fighting the system any way they can. Today we are talking about the worst industrial project in the world,
the tar sands,
which is destroying boreal forests, rivers, and territorial lands of the indigenous people of the region. We had the privilege to interview McDonald Stainsby. We talked about the tar sands, the organizations fighting it, and its connection to the event in Vancouver on stolen indigenous land. McDonald Stainsby is the coordinator of oilsandstruth.org and organizer of Everyone's Downstream. Welcome to the show, McDonald.
Thanks.
So to start off, let's just talk about Oil Sands Truth. When was it set up and why?
Well, the original website shell was set up about 3.5 years ago. It was recreated in the last, or about 3 years back. The primary idea is just to be able to get out information that doesn't rely on anything more than simple data from the very forces out to be critiqued, such as like the corporations and the government. So being independent, it can provide information and provide people with a networking base to allow themselves to make their own decisions as to how to respond to the rapid pace of development throughout Alberta and through North America as a result.
Just to follow that up a little bit, because this is a question that has come up here, is it oil sands or is it tar sands? And which is the more neutral?
Well, the only neutral term would be bitumen sands, as a friend of mine pointed out a couple of years ago, because it's neither tar nor oil when it's dug out.
Right.
So bitumen sands is the down-the-middle term. But oil sands is clearly a rebranding effort that's been underway with particular ferocity for about the last dozen years or so to get away from the image of tar. And I do make the argument quite simply that when you're dealing with tar, you're dealing with a substance that you used to smell as a kid being patched onto the roof of your school, and you could smell tar from miles away. It's a very similar smell to what you get in the areas in and around Fort MacKay, where several of the giant strip mines are operating. And secondly, you know, 300 years ago, the local First Nations were using the tar sands that they were pulling off the banks of the river to patch their canoes. Were we pouring oil on the roof, or were you using tar on the roof when you were patching the ceilings that caused your school to give that smell to the neighborhood? So
right.
If you're going to have to pick one or the other, tar is clearly not a rebranding effort. It's something that more resembles the substance in question.
That's some good clarification there. I'm looking at your website and stuff, but what would you say are the three most important things people should know about the tar sands?
The largest industrial project in human history, if one was to try to figure out a way to visualize it on a scale that's already far larger than they can fathom, I would suggest looking at a state of Florida map put out by the government in the U.S. I believe it was the state itself, and it lists the mining projects that are in operation. There's like 230 different mines. Some of them are open pit mines. And there's even little links you can click on to the various mines that are dotted throughout a map of Florida, and you'll see these giant strip mines with that sort of circular oval into a drain-looking kind of pattern of the dirt. You'll find many of those different kinds of open casts all over the place throughout Florida. 230, I believe, was the number. Then take a step back and realize that the area they're talking about for tar sand development is the size of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And if the sacrifice zone is to be that big, then you can realize you're almost getting into an interplanetary type of level above and beyond what kind of mines you're used to thinking of when you hear the term mine.
Right.
So that's the first thing I want to get into people's head is the scale. You can also look at it as the way to guarantee that you understand that the world is currently living in a stage of peak oil. Peak oil basically illustrates that there's not going to be enough oil to meet demand at a certain point, and economies will start to feel the pinch on that level. People have talked about alternative supplies in the past theoretically being a way to at least head off the very beginning levels of it. Well, for the last few years, the breakneck pace combined with the price of oil sort of demonstrates that we're already at that precipice.
Right.
And do we decide to go after the worst stuff? Do we decide to dig it all out in the, you know, short-term illusion that we can maintain an oil economy, or do we save what we have left and get beyond it? We don't really have a third choice.
Yeah.
That's the question that Tarzan's posed most starkly, is the fate of where we're headed as a collective beings on the planet. As people keep reminding us, the planet will be fine, we're screwed. So we have a decision to make, and the Tarzan's do map that out quite well.
Right.
And thirdly, the Tarzan's, I would say, are the place for people who have visions of a better society in mind and want to infuse a movement that builds that society as building it in demonstration of the way they want to live. I think that comes from dealing with affected peoples at all levels of social struggle. That includes people put into precarious situations for housing, most notably women, quite often indigenous in Alberta, as a result of the disgusting rates of development in northern Alberta and elsewhere, in traditional territories, moving into cities and so forth. When people honor all struggles against violence in domestic situations, through to understanding our relationship to the earth and not as lords over it, through to First Nation self-determination and workers' rights. People are being killed in industrial accidents in these areas as well. Mm-hmm. They're not anything more than the cost of business, just like the idea of carbon.
Right.
So if you're going to try to put together what's the third most important thing, is that we can build a network to take on the largest, most destructive project on earth by keeping it community and keeping it grassroots, that not only can stop this process from going beyond the precipice, but actually allow us to emulate and build on the ground through our own example a real world that's fit for human beings as well as the planet's willingness to put up with us.
Well, that's some good stuff to keep in mind, especially because I don't think people tie that together, that what you're just talking there at the end about the domestic violence, about housing, about the people being killed. I mean, we heard about some of the workers that were just killed there, and it just disappears, and you don't hear about all the accidents that happen as well. I mean, that's pretty much a lot of that stuff's hushed up. So who are the other people besides yourself? Like there's some various campaigns involved in stopping the tar sands. Who are those? What are their names, and how can people get to know them?
Well, as far as contacts, best thing to do is always Google searches on any of the organizations. So those that are active in various different roles they take. Sierra Club works in Alberta at a community level. They're an NGO. They are limited by that, but they also work honestly with people they deal with. At least that's been my experience in Alberta. So the Sierra Club Prairie chapter is one of those. There's also Greenpeace, who take a more direct action and education around like a national climate movement kind of approach to things. And their stuff has been all over the media quite vividly so, the last 6 months in particular, with the first occupations that have disrupted production even for a short period of time. Beyond that, Indigenous Environmental Network does two things. One, educating around tar sands, but from a human rights perspective, and two, trying to do their ability to enable and emancipate, or empower would be the best word, the communities that are primarily First Nations and are front line to development around tar sands, most notably Fort Chipewyan, but also Beaver Lake and other communities that are right in the path of development, so also fence line communities, communities that are near pipelines, et cetera, are referred to. And then, of course, the most important thing, however, is that if you find a community that is affected by this, your odds are pretty good that there's somebody in that community who's already raising the alarm about this. We should be humble in our approach to just hearing the muted voices and trying to help use our access in the cityscape to amplify them, but our primary strength to finding who else is doing a lot is looking to our neighbors. They're a lot more active than we often give them credit for.
Yeah. And there's another thought that just came up. The CBC had on today something about reining in the tar sands. But at the same time, you see, I think I saw something recently that Total is looking at increasing their, I don't know what the numbers are exactly, the whole, their production. So in the media, you're seeing a lot of one side talking about, one hand talking about reining it in. On the other hand, you'll see a lot of other people, like if you look at Bloomberg or something like that, where they're actually doing a lot of talking about a lot of increase in production. So right, what's the sort of the real story there, or is, you know, in the long run, from your point of view?
Well, right now you're going to be seeing both for the simple reason that we're at the beginning of a short-term, I believe, upswing in economic rates around the world. My understanding, you know, I'm certainly open to being corrected by events, but is that peak oil's trajectory now will be to outstrip demand, cause an implosion, and then its price will drop, and then it will be a temporary climb back, and so forth. Each one of those that happens, you see the biggest players in the tar sands, like Shell, like Exxon, and other areas in the world, like Syncrude, Suncor, of course, will be able to buy out middle players. We've seen this already with Suncor taking over Petro-Canada last year, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When that happens, that concentrates more power into fewer hands, and those fewer hands control vast quantities of capital. That capital allows them to see through any slowdown or short-term losses that other corporations can't. As you know, the law of the corporate jungle, you grow or you die. The middle players, when they become insolvent, they can't turn to their reserve and allow that money to float them through to the next cycle. That's when the big players take over, or the middle players do what the pages of the papers and some analysts are talking about, which is defer projects. Opti and Nexen's Long Lake, for example, will slow down. Nexen's a middle player at best. Opti's only operation anywhere is that project.
Right.
They'll take a step aside. They won't expand. They'll probably postpone any expansion plans and see if they can make enough money to stop from going under while prices are still lower. Yeah. Meanwhile, their expansion plans along pipeline companies that are vastly liquid, such as TCPL, such as Enbridge, combined with the giant or corporations like Suncor now, will be able to team up, make partnerships with refineries in the States, with like companies like Sunoco, British Petroleum, elsewise, to be able to do the construction and build up. So the overall targets of getting to 4 to 5 million barrels a day, which have been moved back to maybe 2035 now, those remain the same, and they're not necessarily exactly on schedule, but that's nothing particularly new. It just means they're a little bit of a slowdown overall. All players are pretty much going to be off the map unless there's a huge rebound, and very, very quickly.
Right.
I don't see that happening fast enough, so I think we're going to see more and more monopolization.
Now, you've also been involved with Everyone's Downstream. Can you kind of explain what Everyone Downstream is and sort of what the how it's conceived and what the focus is of it?
Well, Edmonton's like the both financial and to some extent corporate headquarters, you know, excepting Calgary, of course, for tar sands operations, and the first large city within the vicinity of the Fort McMurray hub. Therefore, it's going to have a significance as an organizing hub for activists. And a lot of people from communities, every single corner of Turtle Island are already affected by pipeline development, refinery development, the expansion of mines in northern Alberta. You name it, ports along the coast. These things are a direct result of tar sand operations, and they're being planned on a continental level by a room of 20 to 30 people who have the biggest and final say on these matters. So since they're talking about affecting every corner of the continent, it's important that we be able to try to get together once a year from those four corners to share stories and to, more importantly, network and be able to plan out how we collectively want to respond to decisions they're making at that level. Why should we only be allowed to discuss what's happening within a few hundred meters of our radius? As the people, we have a democratic right, and far more so than the planners do, to respond on the same level that they're operating. So that ability to network is the primary goal of Everyone's Downstream, and to hopefully illustrate through diversity of speakers just exactly that, that there's such a diversity to the movement and so many different issues as well as locations. And if we can collectively move from there to addressing the profound lack of democracy in making these decisions.
The last meeting, you know, I was at the last Everyone's Downstream, there was a lot of talk about building solidarity with Indigenous groups. Can you go into that a little bit more, talk about some of the work that you've done around there and what you think the focus should be there?
I won't lay out a blueprint or a playbook for others. Don't feel qualified in that regard. I'll say that I try to make sure that the voices of those who, in my opinion, do rightfully make the final sovereign calls as to their territory have that without a filter, and that be what is at the front and center of our understanding of social justice in Canada. Social justice is born of colonialism. Any attempt to address social ills in the country that don't start with First Nation self-determination are doomed to failure, even if they're not morally insufficient.
Right.
So prioritizing that also allows a human face and one that's built on environmental justice, an idea that all the social issues of environmental problems have to integrate into a whole. And since the people who live with the land in northern Alberta are the ones who are already dying of these diseases and are having their voices systematically silenced, and even doctors persecuted for mentioning the illnesses of people downstream, then we already have a situation that screams to have those voices be the front and center discussion of the issues around tar sand development.
Right, exactly. Next question is, because I see it on your website, it's like almost at the very top of your browse categories, and that is the Olympics, the 2010 Olympics. So I wonder if you can go into what the tie is between the two.
The tar sands and Olympics?
Yeah.
Well, it's similarly to the theme of discussing social impacts of tar sand development and not seeing it as, you know, as important as they are, just trees, water, dirt, but a whole tapestry. And the same thing applies to the Olympics. And with that kind of holistic approach to what are the impacts, one can see devastating effects on mountains and traditional territories of both animals, as well as First Nations in the area around the Olympics, for development of the highway corridor to move the athletes more freely for a two-week party. And that's given rise to further criminalization and ultimately the murder of Harriet Nahani, the elder from the community of Mount Currie, or Nulwat, of the Stadium. And in the areas in town, you can see massive social cleansing. It's as a result of property speculation and an out-of-control housing market, which is based on the influx of massive construction and massive out-of-control development, with guarantees that they're going to be met by subsidy from the government and allowed to go ahead on that basis. So, you don't know, Olympics sounds like sports and snow and, you know, medals. It's just, and it's not at all like a strip mine in McMurray in the very, very surface way of looking at it. The story ends up being one much the same. Land grab from First Nations, reduced environmental health, reduced social health, particularly in the inner cities, reduction of civil liberties on a rapid pace, the use of temporary foreign worker labor from places like Mexico, China, the Philippines, elsewhere, to build up projects in a ridiculous pace for paying people less than minimum wage. That happens in both Vancouver to build Olympic stuff like the RAV line, as well as it's been taking place in places like CNRL's Horizon Oil Sands plant. The list does go on quite tremendously, but even most important at the very end is the overlap of the same corporate sponsors who attend the same parties and have the same views on both of these as the right. activists would generally point out, that these two events can be coexistent and seen as part of corporate fun day, like the various vehicles and whatnot they were chasing around the Olympic torch celebrations, quote-unquote, right. here in Edmonton. The Suncor bought up Petro-Canada about a year ago, a little less, and as a result of that, that makes Suncor the official energy supplier to the 2010 Games, which are supposed to be the greenest games ever and the first carbon-neutral Olympic.
Right.
Absolute ludicrous statements on all around, right? How many planes are going to be flying in and out of Vancouver to bring in this party? And you're feeling a little bit of it might be first class. And then you look at the Trans-Canada Pipelines, one of the official suppliers. They're the ones building the pipeline across Lubicon territory, which brings us back to the 1988 Olympics. And right. Lubicon still then dealing with the intrusion of oil and gas and unresolved land claim with 22 years later in the same situation. And the Olympics can be used to highlight these situations again. Why are we throwing all of these parties and tearing up the earth while we haven't been able to, as Martin Luther King put it, you know, put God's children on their own two feet?
The other thing that I see a lot, and especially on some of the Stop the 2000, is it? I think it's, I'm trying to remember the right name now. It's called No 2010 Olympics, and that's the correlation between the Olympics and the Nazis, and specifically around the torch. Can you explain a little bit more about that and how how the Nazis influenced some of what's happening in the Olympics these days?
They didn't influence it. They started the torch relay. The torch relay was to show the supremacy of the Aryan race and their skill and athleticism and the promotion of the Nazi Reich, just leading into the 1936 Olympics. So that's what the torch was all about. And the very concept of the torch relay as part of the lead up to the game, as part of the overall hoopla and whatnot between games and passing it around the earth from bearer to bearer to bearer, is a Nazi construction that has been adopted and continues to this day. So that's part of the spectacle. As far as links to fascism, they also go back to the forming of the IOC in the beginning. You can find all sorts of folks who had rather clear political views holding this so-called apolitical event, which has become more and more corporate.
Right.
But I do want to shy away from the emphasis on prior fascist associations, insofar as it's not about saying where they've been, it's about where they are now.
Right. Okay.
And the neo-fascists who have been held in check on certain levels, but not on many, witness the war in Iraq, witness the promotion of their slaughter in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. These are the people promoting this Olympics, using it for militarism today, trotting out the military today while we're continuing to deny self-determination to nation after nation that happens to be in an energy-producing region of the world. So with the previous use of the Olympics to model support behind fascist regime, militarism, and narrow nationalism, it should be of little surprise that since it's become smaller and smaller, the number that makes those decisions around how to promote it today, it promotes the same values despite the democratic facade.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very important point, that we don't look too far back, but also look at what's happening right now, right, and the people that are involved in the Olympics right now, and you know, what else they're doing around the world.
Obama just launched the first time he went to Copenhagen. Wasn't anything to do with trying to stop climate change. He went there to personally try to promote the idea of the Olympics moving to Chicago for 2016. Failed. But, you know, that was within a couple of days of his announcement of the troop escalation in Afghanistan, and about a month before he failed at getting the world behind an actual climate deal. So where are the values and what are being promoted? It's the same story as it's always been.
Right.
That's who controls the Olympics. The athletes are something entirely different.
They're the distraction, I guess.
The only thing I say is that people can find at oilcentric.org maps of all the development and proposed pipelines, refineries, and so on across North America. It also can illustrate all the various communities that are affected. Mm-hmm. So some people will look at that map and be intimidated by it and depressed and concerned that as a result of that development, there's no point in proceeding. But the map should give hope. It's really a map of who your allies are, where people are for the same reasons you are. So it's a horizontal solidarity,
right,
are able to pick up and join in your fight. It's a map of progress. It's a map of hope. So
right.
Real hope.
Okay, great, good. Okay, so do you have time for a couple of Derek Jensen questions?
Sure.
Pick two numbers between 1 and 10.
3.
Okay, 3. Do you know what some of the diseases of civilization are? Has anyone you loved or died of any disease of civilization? Talk about that person.
In civilization in general?
Yep.
Sure. Well, I could say that my father died after abusing tobacco and similar things for decades that ultimately, I believe, was similar to an industrial cause of the end of his death, mm-hmm, or the end of his life. That was when I was quite young, so speaking of someone that died makes that stand out. He was a journalist. I've become a writer as well, so it's something to be aware of as to the various ways that they make us expendable.
Right.
We knew that a long time ago.
When was the most recent time you felt awe, and what was the cause?
The most recent one I can say for certain in terms of awe, over the summer, when I was hitchhiking in southern Yukon on a back road, and the ride ended up breaking down on a road where no other cars were going, and we were there for a good 2.5 hours. No vehicles had gone by. He had ridden in dust on the back of the truck, help. We were probably 150 kilometers from any habitation, or human anyway. And I started to be really, really pleased with the situation, went mildly crazy in a happy way, because I was really happy to not be unhappy. There was a situation as absurd as this one, and there was no need to worry something would take care of it. I felt somewhat connected to the greater realization that it would all be good, and I had enough food for 2 days. So it only lasted about another half hour, and the car actually kicked over and started working on its own. I don't know what shut it down in the first place. And we never did figure it out, and we drove out of there in one straight swoop. And along the route on our way into Watson Lake, we passed a forest fire that surrounded us. It was on this hill, maybe 100 meters at most to the left side of the car. Right. So I guess that would be the north. And the size of the flames was rather intimidating. The only reason we were driving in the dark is because we'd had that long breakdown.
Right,
so it was in awe of a lot of things that day. One of them was the power of a forest fire.
Yeah, that'd be something.
There you go.
Hey, great. Well, thank you very much. That's great. Well, thanks for being on the show, McDonald.
Cheers.
One day I'm gonna go. One day I'm gonna be gone. There's nothing left for me here. There was something in me dying, and now it's done. And it's crystal, crystal clear. It's crystal, crystal clear. Right now when I look around, I know what it's like to know what it's like when you look around at the likes of something like you've never seen before. So I'm up and leaving, and it's for a good reason. I'm fucking tired of breathing these chemicals every season. And they say it's funny how things can change so fast, but there ain't nothing about it that makes me wanna laugh. It makes me wanna get gassed. It makes me wanna pass on the line where this crowd's lined up, back to the last one, all looking for something, or maybe just standing around with all the eyes on the skies. Why we're losing so much ground? Would the sea you lost, looking for the island I found? But I'm not waiting around for the ship to go down. I'm singing, one day I'm gonna go, one day before not too long.
The Filthy Politicians with One Day. Next week on the show, we'll have Sheila Muxlow, coordinator of the water campaign for the Sierra Club's Prairie chapter, talking about Got Thirst and what the Alberta government is planning for water. I think this is going to be an important show for everyone to get an idea of what the powers be are thinking around water. Taking us out will be Count Zero with Click and Cling. Thanks for listening, and remember, folks, the resistance needs you.